So again, Michael Vernon Townley cooperating not only with Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson on the actual assassination of Orlando Letelier here, but interestingly enough, he meets with Senator James Buckley on the same day he meets with Frank Turple. And both the Buckleys were involved in helping to circulate the myth that the American left had been involved in, the Chilean left, rather, involved in killing Orlando Letelier. By the way, broadcasting from Foothill College, you're listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills. We're going to take a musical break now, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to look at a woman who was the first publisher of Ms. Magazine, a woman named Elizabeth Forsling Harris. And so again, bear in mind, before we come back to that, bear in mind Steinem's relationship, long relationship, to J. Stanley Pottinger, and Pottinger's role in covering up the assassinations of Orlando Letelier and Martin Luther King, as well as his role in the possible role in the smuggling of arms to Iran and possible attempt to free the hostages. We'll be back in a few minutes after a musical break, and then we're going to proceed with some more interesting connections about the whole Ms. Magazine axis, and I use the word axis advisedly. We're talking about Gloria Steinem, her association with the Central Intelligence Agency, with Ms. Magazine, of course, with people like Gloria or Catherine Graham, with men like J. Stanley Pottinger. We just took a look at Pottinger's possible role in an arms smuggling scam and his definite role in covering up the assassinations of Orlando Letelier and Martin Luther King. Now we're going to take a look at the interesting extracurricular activities, I guess you could say, of a woman who was the first publisher of Ms. Magazine. Now, sometime in the early 70s, a woman named Pat Carbine, sort of ironic in light of Pottinger's role in these assassinations, she became the publisher of Ms. Before that, the publisher of Ms. Magazine was a woman named Elizabeth Forsling Harris. And it appears that Elizabeth Forsling Harris played a primary role in the assassination of John Kennedy. Reading from Volume 4, one of the best series of books on the Kennedy assassination. It's called Forgive My Grief. It occurs in four volumes. It's authored by Penn Jones, Jr. Now, Penn is the editor of the Midlothian Mirror. Midlothian is a suburb of Dallas, and he's one of the foremost researchers and a man who began investigating the Kennedy assassination on 11-22-63 and stuck with it for a long time, far longer than most. And he published Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, in 1974, copyright 74, privately published by Penn Jones, Jr. in soft cover. By the way, the title comes from a poem, In Memoriam, Alfred Lord Tennyson. It says, "Forgive my grief for one removed, thy creature whom I found so fair. I trust he lives in thee, and there I find him worthier to be loved." Just a lot of people have wondered where that reference comes from. But anyway, far more important than that reference is the association of Gloria Steinem and Ms.'s first publisher, Elizabeth Forsling Harris. And it appears that Elizabeth Forsling Harris was involved in planning the assassination of John Kennedy. Interesting in light of Steinem's paramour, J. Stanley Pottinger, and his connections to not only the assassination of Martin Luther King, but also his association with people like Michael Vernon Townley, Frank Turple, Edwin Wilson, and not to mention George Bush, in the assassination of Orlando Letelier. Reading now from Forgive My Grief, Volume 4. By the way, most of the articles in this in Penn's books are actually editorials or investigative columns done by Penn in the Midlothian Mirror, and this is one of them. Infiltrating again. The women's liberation movement, as well as the youth movement, must constantly be aware of the problem of infiltration by enemies. In fact, the liberation group may very well have been taken over already by the Ms. publisher, Elizabeth Forsling Harris. According to the Dallas papers, Mrs. Harris accompanied liberation leader Gloria Steinem during the Steinem appearances in Dallas. Since reading Coup d'etat by Edward Luttwak, it is easier to understand the enormous planning and checking and double-checking necessary before the killing of President John Kennedy could be successfully accomplished. Taking over the most powerful country in the world is not a small task. Having constant surveillance on the opinion makers in Dallas was only one of the necessary requisites in the planning stages. Betty Forsling Harris appears to have been one of the high-level observers moved here from Washington. She left Dallas shortly after the assassination. Elizabeth Forsling came to Dallas a few years before the assassination. She was a great and good friend of Stanley Marcus of Neiman Marcus. She married and divorced Leon Harris of the A. Harris firm. Elizabeth Forsling Harris worked for the Saul Bloom Advertising Agency and was referred to by Washington planners as, quote, our Dallas contact, unquote. She attended the important planning sessions for the coming visit of the president. The Bloom Agency handled the public relations for the visit, then also handled the public relations for the Jack Ruby trial. This was a first for any court to have a public relations firm employed in a court case. Elizabeth Forsling Harris was a very close co-worker with Jack Puterbaugh on the Dallas trip which cost the life of President John Kennedy. Puterbaugh came to Washington from Minnesota with Orville Freeman. In the Agriculture Department, Puterbaugh was working closely with Billy Saul Estes, later convicted and sent to prison. It was Puterbaugh who made the decision to hold the lunch in the trademark, quote, because of the proximity to Love Field, unquote. And it was Puterbaugh who made the decision to take the unauthorized and unnecessary detour in Dealey Plaza. The two decisions make Puterbaugh up to his hips in the assassination. Neither he nor Betty Harris were ever questioned by the Warren Commission. And again, the Blum Agency handled the PR not only for President Kennedy's visit to Dallas, but also handled the public relations for Jack Ruby's trial. This was the first time any court had had a public relations firm employed in such a capacity, although my understanding is that that has now become fair. I was called by an attorney after I mentioned this before. Apparently that is now sort of standard operating procedure where anyone can afford it. So this was sort of a groundbreaking event. One thing that is not included in that particular article about the Blum Agency, and recall that's with whom Elizabeth Forsling Harris was working, but is that Oswald had visited the Blum Agency a number of times before his alleged and obviously non-existent role in the assassination of Kennedy. The important thing in examining Oswald, by the way, as we looked at in not only the Guns of November, but in a number of Radio Free America shows, the Aryan Nation series and World Anti-Communist League series in particular, but the important thing about examining Oswald is to find out who manipulated him in such a way as to take the fall for the Kennedy assassination. Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill anyone. The point here is that Elizabeth Forsling Harris appears to have been a primary planner in the Kennedy assassination. She was never questioned by the Warren Commission. She worked for the Blum Agency, which had some curious roles throughout the trial. And beyond that, she was heavily involved, along with Jack Puterbaugh, in planning the motorcade route for John Kennedy. That was that of necessity, for those who've studied the details of the assassination, has to have placed her, as Penn Jones indicated, in the very center of the conspiracy itself. And as we've looked at in our Aryan Nation series, as well as the Guns of November, the Kennedy assassination was, for all intents and purposes, a military coup. Now, again, perhaps the Steinem association with Elizabeth Forsling Harris in and of itself wouldn't be too damning, but in light of all of the other information, the Independent Research Service connections, in light of her association with J. Stanley Pottinger, and some of the things Pottinger's been involved in, that's also, it's one more very, very interesting detail concerning Steinem and her involvement in a very, very deep intelligence milieu. And again, Elizabeth Forsling Harris replaced, ironically enough, by Pat Carbine, or Carbine, as publisher of Ms. Magazine. Now, the last person that we're going to take a look at, and we're going to take a look at, well, the next to last person, actually, in considerable detail here, is the aforementioned Catherine Graham, a principal stockholder in Ms., one of the people who helped lean on Random House for the deletions in the book The Feminist Revolution. Catherine Graham is, as mentioned, one of the key people who helped found Ms. Magazine in the first place. Catherine Graham, as well as the entire Washington Post milieu, has a long-standing relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. That information came to light in a book called Catherine the Great, subtitled Catherine the Great and the Washington Post, published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. It's authored by Deborah Davis. And I'll give you the copyright date here in a second. It's copyright 1979 by Deborah Davis. And I would point out that this book is very, very difficult to find because it was suppressed, almost certainly because of the CIA connections revealed in it. Now, what we're going to be looking at here, again, and this is in a sense placing the whole Ms. Magazine situation in a much larger framework, is basically that the Washington Post is part of a, well, I guess you'd have to say ironically enough here, an old boy network, which is one of the major axes of the CIA's involvement with the news media. Now, the first element, where we're going to begin looking at the evolution of the Washington Post in conjunction with the Central Intelligence Agency, and then we're going to take a look at Catherine Graham's role as head of the Washington Post and the Washington Post's role in getting rid of Richard Nixon on behalf of the U.S. National Security Establishment. As I indicated, Watergate was a much, much deeper... Watergate was much deeper, I guess one could say, extending the metaphor, than the popular imagination has generally conceived. But we're going to take a look at Catherine the Great and her involvement with the CIA and Watergate a little later. But beyond that, we're going to take a look at Washington Post as basically part of, as I said, a long-standing CIA intelligence media milieu. First thing we're going to look at here is the establishment of an operation called Operation Mockingbird. This was set up not only by Washington Post publisher Phil Graham, the former husband of Katherine Graham, but also a CIA official named Frank Wisner. We've taken a look at Frank Wisner's role in importing the Ukrainian fascists and SS units in Radio Free America's 1 and 2. And in Radio Free America show number 15, we looked at the role of these same elements in the assassination of John Kennedy and setting up a left cover for the assassination. We also took a look at the role of Wesley Liebler, a law partner of Frank Wisner's, in covering up the white Russian and Tsarist and Russian fascist connections to the assassination of John Kennedy. That in Radio Free America 15. Now, Frank Wisner and Phil Graham were two of the people who helped set up Operation Mockingbird, which was a CIA media propaganda effort. Deborah Davis writes about this in Catherine the Great as follows. Frank Wisner, like Phil Graham, had been born a Southerner and had made his own way into the Northeastern legal establishment. During the war, he had been recruited into the OSS by William Donovan, whose house the Grahams had bought and had been sent to the Balkans, where he conceived of and executed operations that became models for future psychological warfare. He had been excluded from post-war intelligence because of bureaucratic infighting, had been asked to return as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Occupied Countries and Intelligence Post, and by September of 1948, he was named Director of the Office of Policy Coordination, the covert operations arm of the CIA. OPC and CIA were officially merged in 1952. At OPC, Wisner developed the vision that the war against communism would be fought not as another large war, but as a series of guerrilla-like skirmishes, unquote, a situation that he sought to control. Sometimes, in cooperation with embassies or the Marshall Plan outposts, and sometimes not, Wisner had already begun wide-scale recruitment of foreign students and infiltration of labor unions. But he wanted something more. A way not only to subvert and disrupt, but to give foreign peoples a sense of America, to alter their perceptions, unquote, against communism without violence, and thus Wisner, his deputy Richard Helms, and Philip Graham conceived of a formal program to recruit and use journalists. A haphazard practice until then, it was said to have had the code name Operation Mockingbird. Philip Graham here again, one of the people working with Richard Helms, later Director of Central Intelligence, and CIA official Frank Wisner, was one of the people who helped develop this Operation Mockingbird, the first and longest-running and most successful of the many, many CIA programs infiltrating and manipulating the news media. The next thing we're going to look at is the primary role that the CIA has played in building the Washington Post over the years and the Washington Post Corporation. Again, returning to Catherine the Great by Deborah Davis. But the Post was also unique among news companies in that its managers living and working in Washington thought of themselves simultaneously as journalists, businessmen, and patriots, a state of mind that made them singularly able to expand the company while promoting the national interest. Their individual relations with intelligence had in fact been the reason that the Post Company had grown as fast as it did after the war. I'm going to read that sentence again. Their individual relations with intelligence had in fact been the reason that the Post Company had grown as fast as it did after the war. Their secrets were its corporate secrets, beginning with Mockingbird. Philip Graham's commitment to intelligence gave his friends Frank Wisner and Alan Dulles an interest in helping to make the Washington Post the dominant news vehicle in Washington, which they did by assisting its two most crucial acquisitions, the Times-Herald and the Washington Post, and WTOP, excuse me. The postmen, that's obviously a radio station in Washington, the postmen most essential to these transactions other than Phil were Wayne Coy, the post executive who had been Phil's former New Deal boss, and John S. Hayes, who replaced Coy in 1947 when Coy was appointed chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. It worked like this. Hayes had been commander of the Armed Forces Radio Network, ETO, European Theater of Operations, and in that capacity had made intelligence connections all over Europe. He came to the Post after turning the network to the service of the Marshall Plan with the title of Vice President for Radio and Television. In Washington, he became friendly with Frank Wisner, father of Mockingbird, and with Alan Dulles, an OSS man who became the second director of the new CIA in 1953. I would interrupt, of course. We've looked at Dulles' role in the Bay of Pigs and the importation and manipulation of the Galen Organization, as well as the assassination of Kennedy. Continuing. The relationship with Dulles was particularly important because of Dulles' ties to Wall Street, from which intelligence, industry, and government all draw their leaders, the men who form this country's ruling clique. Between 1937 and 43, when he joined the OSS, Dulles had been a director of the Schroeder Bank, which in Germany had misjudged the oneness of corporate and national interests to the extent of helping to finance Hitler because he promised to stabilize the German economy. From his membership in the tiny merchant banking community, which includes at any time only about 100 active partners distributed among the Morgan, Lazar, Rothschild, Hambros, and Baring houses, Dulles knew and respected former Lazar associate Eugene Meyer. From his corporate law work at Sullivan and Cromwell, the preeminent foreign policy law firm in America, Dulles was close to Post Company attorney Frederick S. Beebe at Kravath, Swain & Moore, another foreign policy firm. A quiet, thoughtful man, Beebe had been recruited out of Yale, 1938, by Kravath's senior partner, Roswell Gilpatrick, later the Assistant Secretary of Defense under Robert McNamara during the Vietnam War. At Kravath, Beebe had been assigned to handle estate planning and other legal affairs for the Meyer family. That's the family from which Katharine Graham came, by the way. For the Meyer family, and eventually became their chief corporate as well as personal counsel, representing their interests in every significant transaction over three decades, including the legally complex, monopolistic acquisition of the Times-Herald in 54. I'm going to reread that last sentence. At Kravath, Beebe had been assigned to handle estate planning and other legal affairs for the Meyer family, and eventually became their chief corporate as well as personal counsel, representing their interests in every significant transaction over three decades, including the legally complex, monopolistic acquisition of the Times-Herald in 54. The merger was critical for Katharine's family, confirming their power and influence in Washington and making the paper financially safe enough for her son Donnie, unquote. It was also critical to Hayes, Phil Graham, Beebe, Wisner, and Dulles, men who had a political interest in her family's newspaper, because the Times-Herald maintained a bank of dossiers that it routinely made available to the FBI, the CIA's rival in domestic Cold War intelligence. When Colonel McCormick, that's Robert McCormick, and we've looked at him, by the way, too, in connection with America First, when Colonel McCormick decided to sell his nearly bankrupt Washington newspaper, he asked Eugene Meyer the price of $8.5 million for it, about three times its worth. John Hayes went to Chicago in March of 1954 to make the initial payment in cash. The merger drove up the value of the Post stock and made the executives richer. It also increased the CIA's access to information, news sources, and cooperative newsmen to the benefit of Mockingbird, which Frank Wisner had been expanding throughout the Cold War. Now, the next thing we're going to be looking at here, so reviewing that section very briefly, not only in its acquisitions of radio station WTOP, but also the McCormick newspaper Washington Star, Washington Times Herald, excuse me, basically, the CIA was intimately involved in assisting the Post, and thereby also, obviously, assisting itself and cementing its relationship with one of this country's major papers. Now, the next element of the Washington Post-CIA association we're going to be looking at concerns Washington Post editor Ben Bradley, his brother-in-law, a man named Cord Meyer, a CIA counterintelligence official operating under James Jesus Angleton, and also a fellow named Richard Ober. Now, Richard Ober is a close friend, an old buddy of Ben Bradley's. Richard Ober also went to work for CIA, and Richard Ober later was to become Deep Throat himself. We're going to talk about that in a minute. The point is here, Cord Meyer is another CIA counterintelligence official. He is the brother-in-law of Ben Bradley here. In 1956, Ben and Tony Bradley are part of a community of Americans who have remained in Paris after having been trained in intelligence during the war or in propaganda at the Economic Cooperation Administration. Many have now addressed themselves to fighting communism, a less visible but more invidious enemy than Nazism had been. Some of them, like Bradley, are journalists who write from the Cold War point of view. Some are intelligence operatives who travel between Washington and Paris, London and Rome. In Washington, at Philip Graham's salon, they plan and philosophize. In foreign cities, they do the work of keeping European communism in check. Bradley's childhood friend Richard Helms is part of this group. He has written portions of the National Security Act of 1947, a set of laws creating the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, the latter to support the CIA with research into codes and electronic communications. Helms is the agency's chief expert on espionage. His agents penetrate the government of the Soviet Union and leftist political parties throughout Europe, South America, Africa, and Asia. Angleton and Ober are counterintelligence and run agents from Washington and Paris who do exactly the opposite. They prevent spies from penetrating American embassies, the State Department, the CIA itself. Head of the third activity, covert operations, is Phil Graham's compatriot Frank Wisner, the father of Mockingbird, whose principal operative is a man named Cord Meyer, Jr. Meyer was a literature and philosophy major at Yale and is consequently well-liked by Angleton, who, when at Yale, thought of himself as a poet and edited a literary magazine. Meyer is married to Tony Bradley's sister, Mary Pinchot Meyer, the woman who later became Kennedy's lover and was murdered in 1964. Among the fascinating and glamorous Americans of Paris, London, and Rome, the Meyers are more fascinating and glamorous than the rest. Mary was the most brilliant and beautiful girl in her class at Vassar and is now a painter, beginning to be critically recognized. That, of course, is at the time they're writing here. She's dead and was dead a good 15 years when the book was published. We'll look at her death here in just a couple of minutes. Cord is an attractive, articulate figure whose evolution as an anti-communist has given him a unique understanding of communist trends in European trade union and Third World liberation movements. Because of this specialized knowledge, he is, as few men are, considered within the agency to be indispensable. Point is here that not only was Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, himself trained in intelligence, very close to not only Richard Helms, who was CIA director at the time of Watergate, but also to Cord Meyer, his brother-in-law, a key CIA counterintelligence official, and also a man named Richard Ober. We're going to talk about Richard Ober a little later. But again, the point here is that the Washington Post is really, like many other newspapers in this country, inextricable from the U.S. intelligence establishment, and that very relationship was indispensable, I should say, in helping the Washington Post to grow as an institution. Now, although Philip Graham was one of the people who helped set up the working relationship between the Post and other news media with the CIA, he eventually, for reason or reasons unknown, began to disintegrate mentally. And one of the interesting symptoms, if one could call it that, of his mental disintegration is that he became very vocal and critical about the CIA relationship with the news media, which, of course, he had helped to set up in the first place. Again, reading from Catherine the Great. Of Philip Graham, she writes, "He had begun to talk, after his second breakdown, about the CIA's manipulation of journalists. He said it disturbed him. He said it to the CIA. His enchantment with journalism, it seemed, was fading. Quote, newspapers are the rough drafts of history, he now thought. Media politics did not become history until the moral judgments were in. As he became more desperate, unable to control the forces that controlled him, one of the manic depressive's greatest fears, he turned against the newsmen and politicians whose code was mutual trust and, strangely, silence." So it's worth noting here that upon the eve of his death, which in turn was a few months before President Kennedy was to be killed, and obviously the whole thing was very much in the workings at this time. People can check our archive tapes for that. I'll tell you more about those later. But it's interesting that Philip Graham had become disenchanted and vocally so about the very relationship between CIA and the media that he had helped to set up in the first place. Now, eventually, as a result of this mental disintegration, Philip Graham was interned in a very well-known mental institution called Chestnut Lodge. Many people have suggested that Chestnut Lodge is one of the many CIA mind control institutions, or ones that have been affiliated with it. I can't document that. It's something I've heard said, but it is interesting in light of the long-standing and successful effort of the CIA to not only use mind control techniques, hypnosis, psychosurgery, and psychopharmacology to get people to commit assassinations, but then to commit suicide themselves later, thereby sealing their lips. It's worth noting here because upon leave from Chestnut Lodge, Phil Graham blew his own brains out in July of 1963. Or better yet, make that August of 63, just about 23 years ago, just a little over at this point. Reading again from Catherine the Great. "Death preoccupied Phil all that spring. Three times, with permission to leave Chestnut, he visited Edward Bennett Williams to rewrite his will, each time reducing Catherine's share of his estate. On the second visit, he demanded that Williams burn the first will. On the third, he had him burn the second. These wills rescinded and superseded a carefully thought-out document of long standing, one that provided trust funds for his children and gave the bulk of his estate to his wife. After he died during probate, Catherine's lawyer challenged the legality of the last will. The probate proceeding enabled Catherine to take control of the Post with no significant legal problems, although with the discredited will not on the public record, it is not known whom Phil might have designated in her place. Manic depressives frequently plan their deaths on the anniversary of a significant event. Saturday, August 3rd, 1963, was the 15th anniversary of the formation of the Washington Post Company, the umbrella corporation for the Post and other properties, in which Catherine and Philip Graham were sole partners. On the morning of August 3rd, Phil telephoned Catherine from Chestnut Lodge and said that he was feeling much better. He asked if he could spend the weekend with her on their farm. Catherine called Joe Rao and told him happily, "Phil is better. He's coming home. Why don't you come over and see him on Tuesday?" Unquote. On Monday, he would spend the day with the children. She picked him up at Chestnut Lodge that morning, and they drove to a small Virginia town called Warrenton in Fauquier County, 42 miles southwest of Washington in the Virginia hunt country. The farm, Glen Welby, was that of a gentleman and weekend hunter, equipped with television and telephones, books and paintings, shotguns for hunting deer, and rifles for quail shooting parties, horses, servants, a large, well-stocked kitchen and bar. Catherine and Phil spent some time together, and then Catherine took a nap. Phil went downstairs, sat on the edge of the bathtub, and shot himself in the head. Again, he may very well have been disturbed here. However, one of the X factors that's missing here from Catherine Graham, or from Deborah Davis's ruminations on the death of Phil Graham, is his longstanding with intelligence, and in turn, as I said, the longstanding, ongoing, and highly successful attempts by the CIA to institute mind control, including training mind-controlled assassins, and consequently, as we looked at in our Radio Free America series on mind control, to get some of those assassins or apparent assassins, they're often used as decoys, to commit suicide. So whether or not the death of Philip Graham here, who had become disenchanted with the pattern of CIA cooperation with the media, had anything at all to do with CIA mind control, remains to be seen. As we like to say here, food for thought and grounds for further research. It is worth noting, though, that this happened just about 3 months before the assassination of President Kennedy. It's also worth noting that Philip Graham's discredited wills might have wrested the Washington Post, at least to a certain extent, away from the CIA, which had been so inextricably involved with it from the very beginning. And, of course, one of the main names to take note of here, again, by way of noting how the Washington Post really is sort of a part of an old intelligence old boy network here, is the name of Edward Bennett Williams, one of the owner of the Washington Redskins for a while and now the Baltimore Orioles. Edward Bennett Williams is one of the prime intelligence-related attorneys in the United States. His clients not only include Richard Helms, whose association with Ben Bradley we looked at a while ago. Helms, of course, CIA director at the time of the overthrow of the Allende government, and which he worked with Henry Kissinger, Steinem's old lover, among others. But Edward Bennett Williams has represented John Connolly, Jimmy Hoffa, Robert Vesco, and interestingly enough, it was while working as an investigator for Edward Bennett Williams' law firm that Robert Mayhew, formerly of the Hughes Organization, helped set up the organized crime assassination teams, which were allegedly to be used against Castro, but there's some indication that they were used against John Kennedy instead. Again, documentation on that on Guns of November program number one, the first of our four programs on the assassination of John Kennedy. It's worth noting here now, too, that surrounding the death of John Kennedy, we have an interesting situation where not only does Philip Graham bow out in sort of grisly fashion, but also after John Kennedy was killed in October of 1964, Mary Meyer, the ex-wife of Cord Meyer, the brother-in-law of Ben Bradley, who, remember, himself had intelligence connections, Cord Meyer, a key CIA counterintelligence official, Mary Meyer was murdered, her diary then appropriated by CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton. Reading again from Catherine the Great. Ben Bradley was considered by some members of the Washington press to be insensitive and ruthless professionally and socially. He was indiscreet about having been on intimate terms with Kennedy, one aspect of which was that his sister-in-law Mary Pinchot Meyer, who had lived in Bradley's renovated garage, had been Kennedy's lover. Mary Meyer had been murdered in October of 1964. She was killed near her house or by the C&O Canal in Georgetown, shot or stabbed. The location, even the manner of her death, varies with each account. Immediately after she died, James Angleton, the CIA's chief of counterintelligence, searched her apartment for a diary she had kept about Kennedy and took it to CIA headquarters, supposedly to burn it, although because of his training, he never destroyed any document. A year later, when Bradley went to the Post, the slaying was still unsolved. In parentheses, Davis adds, it has never been solved. Bradley was uncharacteristically silent about it. So the point here again is that right around the time John Kennedy was leaving this world, a lot of the people within the whole Washington Post axis, and again I use that term advisedly, were also bowing out in grisly fashion here. Phil Graham and the late unfortunate Mary Pinchot Meyer being a couple of them here. Now the last two details that we're going to look at here, in a sense are sort of an abbreviated look at the Washington Post and CIA involvement with CIA in the Watergate case. Now, one of the aspects of Watergate that has not received enough publicity is the fact that it appears almost probable that the CIA, as well as other elements of national security establishment, wanted Richard Nixon out for a reason or reasons which are debatable. Catherine or Deborah Davis here gives some reasons. We're going to entertain those. I'm going to suggest a couple of others here in a couple of minutes. Now, we could go into the indications of CIA involvement in Watergate all day. Unfortunately, due to time limitations here, we're not going to be able to do it. Suffice it to say that James McCord, who was a very, very high-ranking intelligence official, head of the security committee, security organization for the committee to re-elect the president, led the Watergate burglars into the Watergate Hotel. Now, one of the things that McCord did is, after placing a piece of tape on a door to alert him as to whether or not their presence, that is, the plumber's presence, had been discovered in the Watergate, when he discovered that tape missing, he then replaced the tape without notifying the other plumbers. For a man of McCord's very, very long-standing and sophisticated involvement with the intelligence community, that is frankly incredible if one is to accept that James McCord was not a double agent placed within the Plumbers organization to get rid of Richard Nixon on behalf of CIA and others. That is the general view of most researchers, simply because as soon as McCord saw that tape missing, he has to have known that their presence in the Watergate Hotel was discovered. There's no other conclusion. He placed the tape to alert him to a discovery when he saw it was missing, not just knocked off, but missing. He has to have known that their presence was discovered. Despite that, he replaced the tape again, didn't alert the other plumbers, and when the security guard saw, at the Watergate Hotel, saw that the tape was replaced again, he notified authorities, because obviously he knew someone was in there. So, again, that's just one of the many indicators that that in fact Nixon's plumbers unit was deep-sixed by CIA from the inside. The motives for doing so remain a matter of debate. Now, obviously people are aware of the role of the Washington Post and Woodward and Bernstein in particular in breaking the Watergate case. It appears that Woodward and Bernstein, through Catherine Graham, the publisher, and Ben Bradley, were manipulated by CIA, and specifically Richard Ober, an associate of Bradley's and of Ben Bradley's, and himself a key CIA counterintelligence official, along with Cord Meyer, Bradley's brother-in-law. Richard Ober was indeed the deep throat who alerted Woodward and Bernstein. Interestingly enough, Richard Ober was also head of Operation Chaos, a CIA domestic counterintelligence operation which involved setting up provocations as well as infiltrating liberal groups and radical groups. Of the Watergate Post's role in removing Richard Nixon and in the Watergate case, Catherine Deborah Davis writes as follows. Watergate was, according to the, now this, by the way, the reference here, of course, is to, you'll see some references here to the book All the President's Men by Woodward and Bernstein. Now, again, referring to the CIA and its involvement with Washington Post in removing Nixon, Davis writes, Watergate was, according to this scenario, a counterintelligence operation of the highest order, carried out for patriotic as well as bureaucratic reasons which were, in the minds of the intelligence directors, one and the same. It is clear what their motives must have been. Kissinger was pursuing a disastrous policy in Cambodia, disregarding the CIA's advice and blaming the CIA when he failed, all the time adding fuel to the anti-war movement. Nixon's harsh and stupid comments, stupid attempts, quote, to get political control over the CIA, unquote, as Watergate burglar James McCord later told the Senate Watergate Committee, his intention to have the agency's judgments conform to, rather than inform, his policies, quote, smacked of the situation which Hitler's intelligence chiefs found themselves in, unquote, before the fall of Germany. I'm going to repeat that last sentence. I think it's very, very interesting. That's a quote of James McCord. Nixon's harsh and stupid attempts to get political control over the CIA, as Watergate burglar James McCord later told the Senate Watergate Committee, his intention to have the agency's judgments conform to, rather than inform, his policies, quote, smacked of the situation which Hitler's intelligence chiefs found themselves in before the fall of Germany. But primarily because Nixon seemed at times to be insane, a terrible and a dangerous head of state, Double Agent Ober, by this logic, arranged for Double Agent McCord to be arrested during the second Watergate break-in. And then Richard Ober, the head of Operation Chaos, the only man in the nation with access to classified information at the White House, the FBI, the CIA, and CRP, became Deep Throat, a favorite of Ben Bradley, an old Harvard chum. Ober's boss, James Angleton, finally had achieved the ultimate dirty trick. Bradley would take all of the risks, and either Bradley would succeed in getting rid of Nixon, or Catherine Graham would have to salvage her newspaper by getting rid of Bradley. Oh, wait a second. That, by the way, was, I just read that out of order. That basically is the view of Richard Ober, the counterintelligence chief, the counterintelligence official of CIA. The more information that in fact, Richard Ober was Deep Throat, and that the CIA and Washington Post were involved in removing Nixon is added here by Deborah Davis. Doesn't really matter the order here, but I read that a little out of order. But again, reading more about the use of Washington Post by CIA and CIA counterintelligence to remove Nixon, Deborah Davis writes as follows. The minor deception in the book is that only Woodward knew who Deep Throat was. That book, of course, All the President's Men. Bradley knew him, had known him far longer than Woodward. There was a possibility that Woodward had met him while working as an intelligence liaison between the Pentagon and the White House, where Deep Throat spent a lot of time, and that he considered Woodward trustworthy or useful and began talking to him when the time was right. It is equally likely, though, that Bradley, who had given Woodward other sources on other stories, put them in touch after Woodward's first day on the story, when Watergate burglar James McCord said at his arraignment hearing that he had once worked for the CIA. Whether or not Bradley provided the source, he recognized McCord's statement to the court as highly unusual. CIA employees, when caught in an illegal act, do not admit that they work for the CIA unless that is part of the plan. Reading that last part again. CIA employees, when caught in an illegal act, do not admit that they work for the CIA unless that is part of the plan. McCord had no good reasons to mention the CIA at all, except apparently to direct wide attention to the burglary, because he had been asked to state only his present occupation, and he had not worked for the CIA for several years. I think that last statement is open to question. What matters is not how the connection with Deep Throat was made, but why. Why did Bradley allow Woodward to rely so heavily upon it? And ultimately, why did the leaders of the intelligence community for whom Deep Throat spoke want the President of the United States to fall? Again, I'm going to follow this with the explanation as to what Deborah Davis's explanation as to why she felt Nixon was to be unhorsed. Watergate was, according to this scenario, a counterintelligence operation of the highest order carried out for patriotic as well as bureaucratic reasons, which were in the minds of the intelligence directors one and the same. It is clear what their motives must have been. Kissinger was pursuing a disastrous policy in Cambodia, disregarding the CIA's advice and blaming the CIA when he failed, all the time adding fuel to the anti-war movement. Nixon's harsh and stupid attempts, quote, to get political control over the CIA, unquote, as Watergate burglar James McCord later told the Senate Watergate Committee, his intention to have the agency's judgments conform to, rather than inform, his policies, quote, smacked of the situation which Hitler's intelligence chiefs found themselves in before the fall of Germany. But primarily because Nixon seemed at times to be insane, a terrible and a dangerous head of state, Double Agent Ober, by this logic, arranged for Double Agent McCord to be arrested during the second Watergate break-in. And then Richard Ober, the head of Operation Chaos, the only man in the nation with access to classified information at the White House, the FBI, the CIA, and CRP, became Deep Throat, a favorite to Ben Bradley, an old Harvard chum. Ober's boss, James Angleton, finally had achieved the ultimate dirty trick. Bradley would take all of the risks, and either Bradley would succeed in getting rid of Nixon, or Katharine Graham would have to salvage her newspaper by getting rid of Bradley. So again, all of that really by way of highlighting the ongoing association of not only the Washington Post, but Katharine Graham, a key partner in the Ms. Axis, in working with CIA. Now, one scenario that is not discussed there by Deborah Davis concerns the possibility that Richard Nixon was not only removed because he was a dangerous leader, but there are a lot of indications that he was removed basically because the military and the far right were upset with his policies of detente towards the Soviet Union and China. The China lobby in particular, and we've looked at that in great detail in Radio Free America shows number 11, 14, and 15, the second of our Aryan Nations programs and our two World Anti-Communist League programs. The China lobby is a dominant and extremely reactionary force in American politics. Nixon was very close to them, and there many researchers feel, and there are indications that they felt betrayed by Richard Nixon, that they wanted a harder cold warrior than Nixon turned out to be, even though he was a lifelong anti-communist, and that as a result, they had him removed. That's another interpretation that many researchers have. I think that is correct. I also think, to a certain extent, Deborah Davis's analysis is correct. In a sense, Nixon wanted to become larger than the system. As of 11-22-63, the intelligence services and military were giving orders to the president, not the other way around. Nixon, although he was not only he was involved in the Kennedy assassination himself, as we looked at in Guns of November program number 3 about Watergate connections to the assassination, Nixon wanted to basically gain control of the whole show. He didn't want to be a servant. He wished to be a master. I think Davis's analysis in that respect is correct, and that was one of the reasons why he was ousted. Many people feel that the Kennedy assassination and Nixon's involvement in it was the lever used to oust Richard Nixon. The fact that his assassination appears to have been, and discussion of it, Kennedy's assassination and discussion of it appears to have been involved with the Watergate tapes themselves, we went into in great length in Guns of November number 3. Also, there's some interesting information in an interview that I had with Gordon Novell, one of the principal figures in Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. That tape, the full tape, is available from DAVCOR, and a little blurb of that is something that you hear on our little promotional cart that I'm going to play in just a couple of minutes. Again, this discussion of Katharine Graham
and the Washington Post and their mutual association with CIA is being included here, not only for the information about Watergate, the fact that CIA official Richard Ober, in charge of Operation Chaos, appears to have been Deep Throat, but primarily because, in connection with all of the other associations, Clay Felker and Gloria Steinem, Elizabeth Forsling Harris, it paints a rather damning picture, not only of Gloria Steinem herself and her association with people like Pottinger and so forth, but that it shows a larger pattern of CIA cooperation with and manipulation of the media. One last item here that I'm going to talk about, actually a review, we read this last week, concerns the curious associations of Geraldine Ferraro. Again, by way of taking a look at reactionary and intelligence infiltration of the women's movement and perhaps at this point control of same. Research credit for this article goes to Ted Rubenstein, and it's from a Betty Beal column. She's a society columnist, in that it was carried in the Cleveland Plain Dealer on October 14th, 1984. It's featured by the News America Syndicate. Again, Cleveland Plain Dealer, October 14th, 1984. Political opponents make strange playmates. You'd never guess it, but ultra-liberal Geraldine Ferraro and super-conservative Roy Cohn are friends. In fact, Cohn, the brash young investigator of the Joe McCarthy days, may have been the first to plug Ferraro for the Democratic vice presidential nomination. It happened at Cohn's birthday party last February at Regine's in the Big Apple. It was quite a do, says Victor Lasky, author of It Didn't Start with Watergate, unquote. Our ambassador to Austria, Helena von Damm, was there, as was prominent New Yorker hostess C.Z. Guest, Barbara Walters, the Rupert Murdochs, Andy Warhol, Bianca Jagger, the Charles Wicks, Baron and Baroness Ricky, de Portnova, and heaven knows who else, and the John Zaccaros. In fact, the Zaccaros had been at previous Cohen birthday celebrations. It was at the last one, however, that the lawyer host introduced Ferraro as the possible next vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party. Playmates make strange politics. Now, a couple of the interesting points about the Roy Cohn-Geraldine Ferraro association and the fact that Roy Cohn appears to have been the first person to promote Geraldine Ferraro as a Democratic vice presidential candidate. Roy Cohn, although a luminary in New York society until his death, he was nominally a Democrat, but he was a loyal supporter of Ronald Reagan, and obviously one of the guiding figures in the far right for a long time. Also, as we've looked at from the book Farewell America, he himself was a participant in the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, the fact that the Geraldine Ferraro financial scandals, as well as her husband's questionable deals with mafiosi, possibly, and real estate manipulation, were a couple of things that really damaged the Democratic campaign in 1984. Questionable whether Walter Mondale would have been able to win at all, but when the Democratic campaign got off on such a low note, it was basically dead from the word go. Mondale never really had a chance, and Geraldine Ferraro is one of the reasons why. Now, the reason, again, that I bring up the Roy Cohn association with Ferraro, and note also that Helena von Damm is a close friend of Roy Cohn's. Of course, her association not only with Ronald Reagan, but Nazi war criminal Otto von Bolsen, we've dealt with in Radio Free America show number 3. Helena von Damm was Reagan's appointment secretary, drew up the lists of people from whom his gubernatorial appointments were made when he was governor of California, and moved into the White House and became special White House executive director for personnel. She chose also, basically, the lists of people to be selected as cabinet appointees in this administration. The question I think has to be asked here is whether or not, perhaps, Geraldine Ferraro's shady dealings or alleged shady dealings and those of her husband were known to Roy Cohn. And again, the possibility of a Watergate-type counterintelligence operation has to be thought of here.